From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you up to date on all of the news that made headlines this week. Now, before we introduce our panel, we're actually going to take the next 10 to 15 minutes to talk with Nate Eaton. He is the news director at EastIdahoNews.com. Nate has been covering the trial of Lori Vailov-Daybell since it started a month ago in Boise, and we wanted to spend a little time getting an update on what's been happening. And just to be fully transparent, because Nate is so incredibly busy, we are talking with him Wednesday afternoon. So even though you were hearing this on Friday, if there is something that happened between Wednesday and today, that is why. So to just give you an update, Daybell is on trial for the killings of her two children, whose bodies were found buried in the backyard of the Eastern Idaho property owned by her husband, Chad Daybell. Nate, thank you for joining us. You have been in the courtroom every single day, correct?
Yeah, every day since April 3rd. That's when jury selection began. And then the actual trial portion began April 10th. And here we are, I believe we're just finishing up week four of testimony, but week five of everything.
So, Nate, what has it been like inside the courtroom? Because, you know, for outsiders, I mean, there are no cameras in the courtroom. So if you are wanting to follow along, I mean, it really is trying to find a reporter like you who has been able to be in that courtroom every single day.
It is. I'll tell you, one of the main things that surprises me is that there's still a lot of interest in the case. And because of that, there are people coming down to the courthouse every single day. You have to reserve a ticket if you actually want to be in the main courtroom. And that gallery holds, I think, around 100 people. And those tickets go within a minute every day. And those seats are full. There are people that have traveled from, I met one guy from South Africa, another from Australia.
What?
People from California, Arizona, Utah, who are coming just to be in that courtroom. And then there's an overflow room also in Ada County that you can listen to, and one in Rexburg for the residents out there. And it is, it moves fast. I think the prosecution has been through over 50 witnesses. Some of the witnesses are on there for 5 or 10 minutes. Some are on there an entire day. The defense has not been doing much cross-examination, although that's increased this week, depending on the witnesses. And what we have here is a story that's taken over three years, and we've learned so much over 3 years here and there, but you're having it all come together. And it's like this big puzzle, and the prosecutions are putting down pieces every day to try to complete the whole picture. And the jury, their job is to see if the picture is what the prosecution says it is, or if it's what the defense says it is. So it's been fascinating to be there every day, to see Lori's reaction, to see the questions that her attorneys ask, and to see the witnesses who have been called.
And Nate, you have literally been covering this case from the beginning. I think it's fair to say that you were probably, I believe, the first reporter to ever report on this incident. And all of the kind of dominoes that fell after this. With that said, though, Nate, I mean, you have been boots on the ground this entire time for the last 3 years covering this. There has been information coming out in this trial that that no one knew about, that frankly has been highly disturbing. But we have learned more about about JJ and Tylee and how they were killed. What other things have come out that frankly have been surprising and shocking?
One of the biggest bombshells, you could call it, was earlier this week when the prosecutors called a DNA witness, and she said that on a piece of hair, so JJ was wrapped in duct tape, his feet and his arms and his mouth was covered in tape and then wrapped in plastic. And then that plastic was wrapped in duct tape. And on that duct tape, which was wrapped around the plastic, there was a hair. And the DNA expert said that that hair is Lori Vailov's. And there's a 1 in 71 billion chance that it's hers. So it's hers. That was huge. That was huge because up until that point, there had been signs that Alex Cox, Lori's deceased brother, was at the crime scene, because his little finger and his palm print were found when they did testing on JJ's body, but there was nothing linking Lori to it. But then that hair, that I think was a key role in the hearing, in the trial. And some other things that have been played. There was a phone call played between Lori's eldest, Colby Ryan, and Lori when she was in jail after the bodies were found. That was played for the jury. It was a very emotional call. Another phone call between Lori and her sister, Summer, very emotional. People in the courtroom were crying because this was right after those bodies were found. So there has been some new stuff that has come in. Of course, all of this is new to the jury. And I think the challenge is to try to follow it all, because there's so many characters, there's so many states, there's so many people, and there's so many things happening during this timeline that at times can be confusing, even for people that have followed it. So I think, though, the prosecution has done a good job laying it all out, balancing the witnesses between, you know, law enforcement and personal family members and friends, and presenting their case.
Mm-hmm. And Nate, I know that there are family members who were in the courtroom. There have been people designated for JJ and Tylee who can sit in on this. What has their reaction been? I mean, Nate, I cannot fathom having to sit there, right? But wanting to be there, but at the same time, having to hear these details of your grandchildren. I mean, these were, you know, young kids, and having to hear detail after detail about this, yet at the same time, being there to be their advocate.
That's how they have described it to me, especially Larry and Kay Woodcock, JJ's grandparents. They've been there every day. There have been days that Kay has not attended, especially on the days when they've shown really graphic autopsy photos, and they've shown photos of what was left of Tylee, and they describe the body parts, and it can be too much for anybody. There was one particular day that was really heavy, where they were showing these photos and talking about the condition of JJ and Tylee, and Larry was sobbing in the courtroom, and other people were crying. And I have seen jurors wiping away tears from their eyes as these photos are shown. And so I've talked with Larry and Kay, and they've said, you know, it's hard to be here, but it's just as hard to be away. And so we might as well be here and see this out until the end. Lori has had no support. She hasn't had anybody come to support her. Her sister did come and testify, but that was on behalf of the prosecution. She was not there for the defense. And from what we have heard, the defense has said they have little or very few, if any, of their own witnesses. So it will be interesting to see if they decide to put her on the stand, or if they don't, and their defense is quite short.
Mm-hmm. So, Nate, let's get caught up to today. And as I said, we are taping this on Wednesday. And there was some testimony, I believe, I don't remember if it was either today or Tuesday, but one of Lori's former friends testified, making a statement saying that Lori threatened to kill her. That was quite surprising as well.
That was huge. That was huge. And the timing of when that accusation came out was also interesting. So the prosecution called this friend of Lori, who is, her name's Audrey Berterio. They met through kind of their religious circle. They were interested in similar beliefs, and they attended conferences together and started hanging out together. And this woman, you know, hung out a lot with Lori, and she started to become uncomfortable, she said, when Lori started espousing these beliefs about zombies and dark spirits and people being possessed. But she didn't know what to do. She was conflicted. And so time went on. She, you know, went different places with Lori. She ends up in Rexburg when Lori was in Rexburg. And this friend said on the stand that she told Lori, I'm done. Our friendship's over. And she said as she went to go up the stairs, Lori then said, I'm going to kill you. I will cut you up, and I can bury you in a place no one can find you. The world isn't as innocent as you think it is. And it really left a mark on this witness. Now, the interesting thing is the defense immediately stood up and said, You were a witness in the grand jury proceedings for Lori Vallow. You didn't say any of this then. This never came up. And it was mentioned today following the prosecution and the defense cross-examining. It was mentioned in redirect. So I don't want to say it was mentioned kind of as an afterthought, but it kind of came at an interesting point during the testimony, and it was never heard before. And the defense was clearly trying to poke holes, saying, how come you just said this today and you've never said this before out of the past 3 years? You're just hearing this now. Of course, the other side of the argument could be that people who are threatened for their life are terrified and they don't want to bring this forward. And she was worried that Lori hadn't been, you know, arrested yet or on trial yet. So that was a key moment that I think will stick with the jury and those people that heard it, because it kind of came out of the blue and was such a huge statement to make.
You know, Nate, I do not want to make light of this at all, because I think the focus needs to be the fact that there are two children who lost their lives, potentially by the hands of their mother, if that is what's proven. With that said, you could not make up this story. It becomes more and more bizarre as this trial goes on. I feel like you are, you know, it's like watching this, not even a reality TV, but I mean, watching something that doesn't even seem real. I mean, can you sense that in the courtroom? I mean, does that make sense? It's just, it is truly so bizarre, and that every day there seems to be something new that comes out.
Yeah, there was a member of the national media who was here, I think the first or second week, and told me that it was so complicated that their bosses weren't sure if they even wanted to touch the story, because you cannot tell this story in two or three sentences or 60 seconds on the evening news. I mean, there just are so many characters and so many people. I've said this before, that if you took this to Hollywood as a script, they would say, no way, you're throwing in everything here. It's too much. But, and we've heard, as I said, we've heard a lot of these things over the years, and we thought, well, it'll all get cleared up in court. But in court, we're hearing more about the plans to get insurance money and the plans to do, point where you want to start, and there can be all sorts of things. But it all boils down to, as you said, two dead children and two dead spouses. That's what this is all about. Tammy, Charles, JJ, and Tylee, and hopefully getting justice for them. And you think, when this trial ends in the next few weeks, we still have a trial for Chad Daybell that has to happen, and he's facing the death penalty if found guilty. Lori's facing life in prison because they took the death penalty off the table. So this will all happen again later this year or early next year, unless Chad somehow agrees to do a plea agreement or something gets worked out.
And before we let you go then, Nate, also, you mentioned two dead spouses, Tammy and Charles. Any word on whether there will be charges filed in either of those deaths? Because we also now know that the cause of Tammy's death, Chad's first wife, was revealed in this trial.
Yeah, so Lori is on trial right now. They combined the charges for her for conspiracy for murder in Tammy's case. She's not actually charged with murder for Tammy, but Chad is. Chad is charged with murder and conspiracy. As for Charles Vallow, Arizona authorities have announced that Lori is facing a pending charge of conspiracy to commit murder for Charles Vallow, but they have said they're going to wait and see how things shake out in Idaho. So I don't know if that means once Lori's sentenced here, they move her to Arizona and she then has a whole new trial there. If they work out some sort of agreement, I think that might be a little ways off. But charges have been filed for all four of the deaths, and now we wait and see what the verdicts are on those.
Any timeline, Nate, as to when this current trial could potentially wrap? And we should note, once it's wrapped up, then it's jury deliberations, and anybody's guess on how long that could be.
Yeah, well, the prosecution has now taken nearly 4 weeks in testimony, and it's gone quicker than expected, simply because the defense has not done a lot of cross-examination. I think the prosecution could rest here in the next few days, and The defense will then take over. And I think potentially we could have a verdict in the next 2 weeks. I mean, that's just me guessing. Anything could happen with the courts. Don't hold me to that. But originally they did plan for 10 weeks for this trial. That was back when it was conjoined with Chad's and back when death penalty was on the table. So it'll be much shorter than that. But definitely by Memorial Day, we should have this thing wrapped up.
Okay. Well, as always, Nate, I know how busy you've been covering this every single day. So thank you for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us and update us. We do appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
Continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable, our panelist, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News and Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. So organizers with Reclaim Idaho are looking to file a ballot initiative for the 2024 general election. Now, this would replace our state's current closed primary elections. And then that initiative would also change our state's general election to go to what's called ranked choice voting. Now, Jimmy and Clark, I know both of you have been writing about this, digging into this, and there is a lot to unpack here. So I want to begin with some context and some history. So Clark, Idaho hasn't always had closed primaries. So can you begin with that piece of the puzzle and how we now have a closed primary and maybe explain what a closed primary is?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, Jim, and thanks for having us on. I think that this is a good topic to talk about this week, and we can really kind of get into some of the details. So I appreciate that. Yeah, the closed primary system in Idaho is fairly new. The Idaho legislature passed a law during the 2011 legislative session. It was House Bill 351 that closed Idaho's primaries. And this followed a lawsuit that the Idaho Republican Party and its former chairman had filed against the state of Idaho and former Secretary of State Ben Yasursa. I know Jimmy had written about the lawsuit a little bit in his piece for Boise State Public Radio. But it kind of goes back to like 2007, 2008, the Idaho Republican Party had passed rules wanting to change the primary system in Idaho to make it a closed primary. And what that means when we talk about a closed primary, and the Republican primary is a really good example of this for the state of Idaho, it means that you're only able to vote in that primary election if you've officially filed paperwork affiliating with the Republican Party. So if you're an independent or an unaffiliated voter or a Democratic voter or a Libertarian voter or a Constitution Party voter, you cannot vote in the Republican primary. That's what it means to be a closed primary. And we're going to kind of get a little bit technical here, but I think that the understanding will kind of help shape people's understanding of this. Even though the law in Idaho is that the primary elections today are closed and have been since the 2011 law passed, that law gave the leaders of political parties the ability to choose to keep their primaries open instead. And that's what the Idaho Democratic Party did. That's why the Democratic Party has open primaries, which are open to all registered voters, regardless of party affiliation, versus the closed primary that the Republican Party has in the closed primary that's on the books for the laws in the state of Idaho. So really, it's a fairly new change. It happened in 2011. Before that, Idaho had open primaries where any registered voter could vote in the primary, but you were limited to only being able to participate in one primary at a time. Mm-hmm. That is to say, you could not vote in both the Republican primary and the Democratic primary. Even when Idaho had open primaries before 2011, you had to pick one or the other, but anybody could vote. And so fast forward to this week on Tuesday, Gemma, like you mentioned, there's a new coalition, and it's called Idahoans for Open Primaries, and it's made up of about five different groups. I think the group that folks will be most familiar with is Reclaim Idaho. That is the organization that led the successful push for the 2018 Medicaid expansion ballot initiative, which passed with about 60.6% of the vote. And they also pushed for the Quality Education Act in 2022, which was to increase funding for public schools. There's four other groups: North Idaho Women, the Task Force of Veterans for Political Innovation, Represent US Idaho and the Hope Coalition are also part of this. And what they want to do is get rid of the closed primary through a ballot initiative that they're hoping to qualify for the November 2024 general election. That's also the presidential election. So what they're trying to do is get rid of the closed primary and replace it with an open primary where anybody in Idaho could vote in the primary, regardless of party affiliation. And then it would change how the results work out of the primary system. The top four vote getters in the primary election would all advance to the general election, again, regardless of party affiliation. And so you could end up with a situation where you could have likely multiple candidates from the same political party advancing to the general election, where there would be four candidates on the ballot. So that's kind of how they would change the open primary part of it. There, I can stop and turn
well,
it
I have
over
a question.
To Jimmy. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I have a question for you, Clark. So if this were to happen and there's this open primary, like you said, up until 2011, we did have an open primary, but you had to choose. Would this put every party on one ballot in the primary?
Yeah, all the candidates would run together in one big primary. So it would get rid of the political party's primary system as we know it, if this passed and was enacted into law and upheld. So yeah, it would get away from the partisan political primaries that we've seen. Everybody would be lumped in together. You'd vote for your favorite, and then the top four would advance. I'll pause for a second and see if you have any other questions. Otherwise, I'll let Jimmy talk about the primary process a little bit before we move on to talk about the changes that would be, happen to the general election.
Yeah, well, so Jimmy, I'm wanting to know, so as Clark mentioned, we have these groups, this coalition that's come together. They want to change this. Why? I mean, what are they critical of about our current system?
Yeah, I think that the folks who are behind this initiative would say that closed primaries don't really represent the true will of Idaho voters. They say that the closed primary system has led to more extreme candidates. They have said that, you know, it disenfranchises people, because we've seen also the move within the Republican Party within the last year to try to strengthen their closed primary to make it so they limit what they call crossover voting, which is essentially, you know, someone who's not a Republican, maybe they were a Democrat or just simply unaffiliated, from voting in the Republican primary, that you would have to affiliate as a Republican within a certain period of time before the election. Otherwise, you couldn't cast a ballot, which is how some of the more far right candidates claimed they lost during the most recent election. Thinking specifically of the superintendent of public instruction candidate, Brandon Durst, who pushed that resolution and rule change at the summer GOP convention. You know, that's an interesting argument because, as Clark mentioned, I mean, there was this lawsuit for many years over whether or not the Republican Party could close its primary. You know, they were arguing that it's their First Amendment right to choose who can be affiliated with the Republican Party. And that's something that federal judge Lynn Windmill agreed with. You know, there was an interesting quote from his decision saying, this is a quote, choosing ideologically extreme candidates is precisely what a political party is entitled to do in its in asserting its right of association under the First Amendment. You know, Judge Windmill said that it's not really the state's place to try to moderate, you know, a party's preferred candidate. So that's the biggest question that I have going into this initiative, whether or not it passes. If it does, then I'm sure there would be some kind of a lawsuit against it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Jimmy, have we heard? Oh, go ahead, Clark.
I was going to say, I think Jimmy's exactly right, that I think that that this is going to lead to challenges, whether it's challenges in the courthouse or challenges in the Idaho State Capitol building. But I talked with some of the folks that are behind the new ballot initiative. And if you look at like the history of Reclaim Idaho, their kind of strategy has been to pick issues that they think are popular with the people of Idaho that are not being addressed by our elected leaders, particularly in the Idaho legislature. They pushed for Medicaid expansion, like we talked about. They pushed for increased education funding, like we talked about. And I get the sense that by going after the closed primary system, they're trying to take on what they view as a problem that produces a lot of these, what they would call injustices, that they're pushing back mm-hmm. against with their individual ballot initiatives. So rather than going at individual issues that they think that the legislature is not taking action on, they're going at what they believe to be the root cause of the problem. And one example that folks have pointed out to me is a lot of the decisions in the Republican primary are extremely important for shaping the government in the state of Idaho, because we are a red state, because we have a Republican supermajority control. So the primaries are kind of like the big decision point. And they're saying, basically, if you look at the total number of people in Idaho, or even the total number of registered voters in Idaho, it is a very, very small percentage, something like 10 to 15% that are voting in the Republican primaries that are making these decisions that shape our state government. And then meanwhile, when you look at the general election, you don't have to look any further back than 2022's general election, where we had dozens and dozens of uncontested races across the state of Idaho where there was only one candidate in the ballot. And so the sense that I get from talking with folks in and around the ballot initiative effort over the last week or so is that rather than going piecemeal and going in and attacking an individual issue with a ballot initiative, they're going at what they believe is a cause of some of these policies that they're upset with. And so mm-hmm. they're really pushing for wholesale changes with this ballot initiative. And Jimmy's exactly right. If they are able to qualify it for the ballots, and we can talk about that process, and if it passes and enacted, I think there are going to be challenges in courthouses and state mm-hmm. capitol buildings, and this will be a drawn out process is what I'm expecting.
Well, I thought it was interesting, Clark, in an article that you wrote recently, and you spoke with Carol Honus. She is a longtime journalist in Eastern Idaho. She's now retired. And I thought she made a very good point when she said it boxes you in the sense that if you are an independent and you want to remain an independent, and we know that there are so many voters in Idaho who register as independents, you're boxed into having to make a choice if you actually want to be able to vote. And I got the impression, Clark, and correct me if I'm wrong, that she wasn't, you know, saying like it doesn't matter if your belief is Republican or your belief is Democrat. No one should have to check that box in order to be able to use their, you know, to be able to have their right, which is to be able to vote.
Yeah, I think you did a good job of characterizing what Carol's position was. Carol lives in Eastern Idaho. She lives in Bingham County, which for decades has elected a steady stream of Republican elected officials. And when I talked with Carol on the phone earlier this week, she said it didn't feel right. She said for professional reasons, she wanted to remain neutral and independent, like you talked about, but she also cared about her community. And she also felt that she considered herself an informed voter, an informed Idahoan. And she wanted to have a say in these elections that were shaping the state's leadership, that were shaping the local leadership. But backed into a corner is the phrase that she used to me, that she said the Republican primary in Bingham County in Eastern Idaho is the only game in town, and you're either voting there or you're not voting. And she said it didn't feel right that she had to affiliate in order to vote in the primary where these decisions are made. And I want to make the point that we're not just talking about journalists here, and this isn't some crusade that journalists are pushing. This was just kind of one example that I highlighted. And Carol said that she talked to her friends and her neighbors in Bingham County who aren't journalists, and many of them also said they would have liked to have remained independent. They didn't necessarily know about formally filing paperwork to officially affiliate with a political party. They kind of liked the idea of being independent, but they also felt this pressure that they would either not be able to vote in the primary when these important decisions are made, or they would have to go ahead and affiliate with the Republican party. And so those were some of the things that Carol and I talked about. And I think you did a good job of summarizing the position there. Mm-hmm.
So, Jimmy, take us through then how a ballot initiative works and how it qualifies to get on the ballot, because this is no easy task.
It's not. It's really hard to compare different states' initiative laws. I mean, they're about half the states, mostly in the West, have a ballot initiative process, whereas Eastern states don't really have that. But it's hard to compare. However, Idaho's process is one of the most stringent, according to experts that I've talked to. So not only do you have to get, in this case, about 64,000 signatures, just a little bit under that total, you have to get those spread out among the 18 of the 35 legislative districts in the state. So you kind of have to go crisscrossing a whole lot of Idaho to get those signatures, and you have to get a certain threshold within that. So they have to turn those into the Secretary of State's office by, I believe, May 1st, 2024. And then, you know, county clerks plus the Secretary of State will look over those signatures, make sure that they're legitimate, that they are actual signatures of registered voters. If that is the case and they get enough signatures spread out across, the state, then it will be qualified for the November 2024 ballot. But like you said, I mean, it's a pretty arduous task. There have been efforts by Republicans, for going back decades, but certainly just this most recent legislative session, a proposed constitutional amendment to make it so you would have to get those signatures in all 35 legislative districts, not to mention that it would significantly increase the number of signatures overall that you would need to get. That failed. However, I would guess that it would come back next year. It's kind of a perennial issue. I don't know if they would try to make it retroactive to apply to this particular initiative. Something else that we should mention is the legislature also outlawed ranked choice voting, which is part of this initiative earlier this session. This initiative would overwrite that, but it's sort of become a rallying call in the last couple days since the announcement was made of, see, look, these leftist Democrats are trying to implement ranked choice voting, which will disenfranchise you and be super confusing to the voters. That's their argument as to why they banned it. It's becoming an increasingly popular method of voting. You've got Alaska and Maine who do it for statewide elections, and a bunch of municipalities do it as well. But those are just a few things that they have to overcome to even get it on the ballot. So lots of volunteers trying to get those signatures across Idaho over the next few months.
Just got a couple of minutes left, about 3 minutes. And so, Clark, I want to quickly wrap up this topic about this ballot initiative going to an open primary and how that would affect then the general election. Can you explain that with our limited amount of time? Because this would have a big impact on our general election, which happens in November, and that's who we actually elect into office.
Yeah, for sure. I'll get into it. And then in the last minute, if Jimmy wants to clean up anything I've left out, we'll go for it. But in addition to changing the primary, it would change the general, like you said. So we would have four candidates that would come out of the primary, regardless of party affiliation, and then be on your November ballot, your general election ballot. Just as before, you would vote for your first choice candidate. What would change is that voters would have the ability to assign their preference to the remaining three candidates. So you would rank them second choice, third choice, and fourth choice. Now, it would create an instant runoff or ranked choice voting system where if someone gets 50% of the first choice votes or more, they win automatically. But if someone doesn't get 50% or more of the first choice votes, then it goes to this instant runoff. The last place vote finisher is eliminated, and their votes would instead go to whoever marked as second choice on each of their ballots. And that process would continue until someone got a majority of votes and was declared the winner. It's based on an Alaska system that was passed in 2020, also by a ballot initiative, and was recently held up and held in place by the courts. And so those would be the big changes. I know we have just a couple of seconds left, so I'll turn it over to Jimmy in case I left anything out.
No, I think you explained it well, Clark. The only thing I would say is that the arguments for and against it are, for it, lots of people who support it say that it's a more fair way. It means that candidates have to appeal to the broadest number of people, since, you know, they would potentially go to a runoff and eliminate any sort of like you know, if we have a situation where there's five candidates in a particular election, one getting like 28% of the vote versus, you know, all the other ones falling behind, then it represents a true majority. Whereas opponents say that, you know, it shouldn't be like that. You should have just one bite at the apple.
I tell you, I think this is fascinating, and it's going to be super interesting to watch to see what happens, because I think this is only the beginning of us hearing about this. Thank you both for taking time to really explain this to us and dive deep into this topic. Really appreciate both of you. We've been talking with our very own James Dawson, as well as Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun. Have a good weekend, you guys.
Happy Fridays.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I have never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine-friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like, what did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast and its latest series, Taking Cover.